Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division meeting will come to order. The first item is on the agenda is a continuation of, from yesterday, our very good, I thought, a good discussion presentation by the Department of Agriculture and Department of Natural Resources and how they were addressing the Emerald Ash Borer crisis that's coming upon us. And the first item on the agenda is Representative Loeffler, because she was here first.
thank you, Madam Chair and members. The bill that I had introduced and presented to the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council was, as I had noted earlier, a product of the Forest Protection Task Force, which we established in law to include federal, state agencies, local governments, the Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Committee, which advises the Department of Natural Resources, the U of M, Extension, and basically everyone, the industrial forest operations in terms of the people who are up north creating lumber and building materials with our tree materials, as well as people from the landscaping industry and nursery. So it was a wonderful opportunity to bring everyone together, but it was anticipating that we had a number of years to prepare. And I think their recommendations have assisted our state and the public in preparing for avoiding Emerald Ash Borer, and partnership with the leaderships of the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Natural Resources, who've really been working as a team to address this. Part of the recommendations was that the task force continue because it wasn't able to get to sort of phase two. We've mostly been focusing on, and our hearing yesterday focused on, how do you detect it, how do we need to get lots of eyes on the trees, how do we train volunteers to be first detectors. You heard yesterday how if you're able to identify trees early in the first year or two of infestation, you can get them from infecting others, particularly if the bugs are brought in by firewood. It's a pretty localized sort of situation. That's the response plan is going to be to slow it, to eradicate it when we can, where we have, you know, isolated outbreaks. And that, of course, is going to bring into questions of who does what, who pays for what, and what strategy is where. And that's where I think we still need some more work. We have heard how some states lost control because they didn't have the right kind of plan. Minnesota has been a lead national leader in gypsy moth, and I think we can be a national leader on this. I brought the dead trees here as a visual because I couldn't bring the pretty iridescent fog. But this is because I wanted you to think about, this is one of the biggest challenges we're going to have to think about. It's not just finding them and dealing with it, creating a delimiting zone, slowing the, convincing people they shouldn't be carrying wood back and forth across the state. It's also about what do you do with the dead trees? Because you can take them down while they're still in the early stages of infestation and you can slow the spread, or you can wait till they die, but you still got a dead tree. Whether you do it fast or you do it slow, you're going to take down that tree. Who is going to take down that tree? Who's going to transport it? Where do they transport it to? Do we need to have some regulatory structure so we don't have infected ashwood going from one county to the next throughout Minnesota, spreading it unintentionally? And how are we going to help our cities and counties deal with the cost of dealing with it? We know that under Dutch Elm, cities and counties across the state are spending millions of dollars just cutting down those trees. Ashwood is very valuable. I learned that it's one of the most stable hardwoods we have. The old wood baseball bats were always made of ash because they were very stable. And we spent a lot of time in this committee talking about hockey, and they make a great hockey stick material. We actually have a hockey stick making industry based in Minnesota. So there's a variety of things that we can do with the wood once we've taken the bark off. But we want to make sure that that bark doesn't end up piled in some place, so we don't want to have it piled, filled with little crawly things. that can do damage and wherever they happen to have gotten dumped. And so we need to kind of get to the next level of planning. The bill that I had prepared on behalf of the Forest Protection Task Force had money for public education and outreach, and money for continuing the work of the Forest Protection Task Force so that all the stakeholders are at the table agreeing on the policies that need to go forward. And it had an emergency response fund, because we were told, talking to the other states and the federal agencies that were participating with us, that there can be a significant delay in response to getting the federal dollars actually into the Treasury and getting authority for the state agencies to hire staff and those sorts of things. And we have a model in Minnesota that is the Forest Fire Fund, in which when we had the Big Pan Lake Fire, they didn't have to wait for the legislature to come in to session and have money to pay for the fire trucks and the hoses and the lunches for the workers. That was all set up in advance, and it gets replenished, and that's the vision of having an emergency response fund, an expectation that some of that would be reimbursed by federal dollars when they come along. We're going to need to keep refining that with working with the administration, with the federal resources as well, but I think we need to start thinking about the policy issues of who's going to, what are we going to do with the leftover wood? What are we going to do when someone sees a lot of dead trees in someone's back 40 and wants to just offer to haul them out and cut them down and haul them off, and may or may not be aware of Emerald Ash Forest? So we're going to have to educate our customers about who they buy wood from as well, and look to our regulatory structures to see if they're adequate. And with that, I'll respond to questions.
Thank you very much, Representative Lawford. Did I had to go present our bill in another committee for a while yesterday, and Representative Morgan whispers to me that we did not talk about the federal money yesterday. Mr. Phillips, do you have any information about the federal money, or Mr. Friso?
And Madam Chair, while he's coming around, I'm just going to circulate. We don't have, we're a frugal legislature, we do not have color copying or printing capabilities. But I do have here, I think, a several maps that are fairly interesting if you want to see how what the risk area is in your area. It has ash population by municipality, ash per acre, and how we compare it to the nation. So I'll just circulate them.
Very good. Mr. Friso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Gary Friso, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And the department receives funding from both the U.S. Forest Service and also from USDA APHIS. And we receive federal funding for both, for a number of exotic plant pests, including tree pests, gypsy moth. We get probably about $500,000 a year. For emerald ash borer, the current, just for the basic survey before the Victory site was discovered, it's probably about $200,000. However, with the Victory site, we have been having discussions with APHIS, and we are in the middle of trying to get some emergency funding to ramp up very, very quickly. I've asked about the timing when we might receive those funds, and it could be as quickly as 2 to 3 weeks, which is a lightning speed for the federal government. And so we're quite optimistic. I don't know the exact figure, but it's we expect at a minimum $200,000 to $300,000, and we're actually asking for considerably more.
Very good. That's good news.
Madam Chair,
Representative Lawford.
I don't know if I should do this. I think dear will forgive me. But dear, you may not have known, but one of the assignments we had as a committee was that you bring a picture that somehow relates to the topics of the group. Would you be embarrassed if I showed this?
Do infestation.
I could add that to my...
Emerald Ash Borer has been described as a forest fire in slow motion, and I think that had the flame.
I could add that to my collage on my desk over at the house.
I'd be happy to leave you this copy.
Good, good. Because the emerald ash borer seems to be multiplying on my desk. Just like it would in the forest. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you folks review a little bit more what's going on in research as far as controlling the emerald ash borer, whether it be by cultural, biological, chemical means, what our options might be in that regard, given that it's not, we haven't found it anyway in the state of Minnesota yet. It spreads slowly. If we can research out a method of control, perhaps we can not have a whole bunch of dead trees.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, research is just, as you know, this is a very recent pest to the United States, and so we've, unlike gypsy moth, which has been here for over 100 years, so there's been a lot of research done on that. Emerald ash borer, also there's been a lot of scientists from USDA that have gone to China to try and learn more about the biology of the insect. Right now there's a great deal of focus on biological control organisms, which is focused in New Brighton, Michigan. They have brought over 3 stingless wasps. There is some promising research that those biological control agents are very good at controlling these. Up to 70% control has been achieved when they've taken American ash trees to China and tried to grow them out. But still, that is very much in its infancy, and it's still expected that that's 4 to 5 years out. There have been very recently some new insecticide introductions that have recently been registered with EPA, but again, those are very labor-intensive, and it's a tree-by-tree treatment. And I think they're just starting to ramp up some research on tolerance and resistance of tree species, ash tree species, but again, that's a very lengthy time period, and really doesn't address the native ash species.
Representative Harfelson.
Thank you, Ann. But if we can slow the progress of this, if we can keep it down to that 2 to 4 miles a year, we have time. And so it seems to me that it emphasizes the need to try and keep this pest from spreading quickly across the state, which goes back to the control of moving firewood as being really what should be the focus of our efforts, it seems to me.
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair, I'd say you're absolutely right, Representative Harkelson, that crossing the spread is important, but even as important, or maybe even more so, is first finding it. Because we suspect, I mean, it's like Wisconsin, it was only on their eastern border. And all of a sudden it appears on their western border, and it looks like a stand that was established 5 to 10 years ago. And so part of that has to be us getting those trained first detectors out throughout the state, volunteers as well as municipal workers and others, so that we can actually start to identify where we're probably potentially already infected and control those. Because that's, I think, the key point. It didn't hop from the eastern border of Wisconsin to the west on its own. It came somehow by some man-made transport, probably.
Just one more question. How large is this area in Wisconsin that is infected?
Just think so.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, that's still being determined. There have been, from the center of the tiny town Victory, and there's been evidence of found as far as 2 miles to the south of the town. And then on some of the islands into Iowa, there is haven't found the actual insect, but what appears to be evidence of the insect. So it was just recently discovered just a few weeks ago, and it'll take the summer to really delineate it. But it looks like, just from the age of the infestation, the expectation is that it would be several miles in circumference.
But I did hear yesterday, right, that the wood could still be used.
Madam Chair,
the wood from
the dead ash
tree. Yes.
Well, they would have to be, if it's infested, they would have to be destroyed in some manner, either chipped to less than 1 inch in diameter, or burned, or some other method to ensure that the viability of the pest is destroyed.
That you're representing Hodge.
Just a follow-up.
If it's not
to that point, yeah. If you remove the bark from the ash, then yeah. Is the bark not safe? Is the wood that the bark has been removed, is that not safe?
Mr. Friesel.
Madam Chair, members, I'm sorry. If the tree had been dead for a long time and the sapwood had essentially dried up, then the wood is really useless, and that's where it needs to be chipped. But you're correct. If the tree is essentially still alive and you have insects, you could debark it and then take I think they recommend a quarter of an inch of the sapwood off. Then that wood is, in fact, usable. It just, you do need to remove the bark, because that's where the insect is living.
And Madam Chair, that's another reason why we want to detect these early, is because then we have a resource that can be used, as opposed to something that just has to be destroyed.
Right. That ash hardwood that you were saying.
Right. Enough. And one thing in discussing the federal fund, I think we need to clarify that my understanding is that there is not at the present time any state or federal money to pay for costs in taking down trees in any connection with this. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Loffler, that is correct. They are still holding out the possibility that if it's a very small, very discreet site, that they may provide some funding, but essentially they USDA APHIS has said that they will not fund eradication.
Any other questions? Thank you for that clarification, Representative Fox. Thank you, Mr. Phillips, Mr. Friesel, for coming back.
Thank you, Representative Loffler.
And thanks for bringing your tree. Representative Hawes, you have a bill, 1967, from which we should hear a little about, to see if there's any ideas contained therein that we want to consider for the Parks and Trails Fund.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. That as the park director during Dutch Elm disease, it was a very scary time, and that was a much larger tree, but it wasn't in the state of the forest. So this is a very significant challenge that the state of Minnesota is going to be taking on in the protection of our ash trees. But today I have a bill before you that has been heard in other committees and has moved forward in other committees, and it's kind of in part in some of the bills now that have been heard, and it's House Fountain 1967, and I would like to have an amendment to that to prepare the bill for the manner of discussion, and that is 967A2 amendment. Madam Chair, committee, would you like me to address that amendment?
I would like you to address it.
Thank you very much. This is the whole bill really is a team effort by committee members as well as myself, and the readers of this, from some of the readers on the committee, noted that they did not like page 2 and 3, pages 2 deleting 2 and 3, because what that would do is would create, just saying, I have a little hole here, I need a park, you have to pay for the park, and that's not what this amendment is about. And so recommended language came back and addressed it for what we think we should be doing, and that was the assessment of needs for a new or expanded regional outdoor recreational systems to preserve and connect high quality and diverse natural resources in areas with concentrated and increasing populations. And so that I think that better describes what the direction that we want to go in. So if we could accept that amendment, I would appreciate it.
Representative Lilly, do you have any comments on that?
Madam
Chair and Representative Howes, I'm just curious. So, like when we were doing during my presentation on the other bill, we didn't really move it.
Right.
So I'm just curious.
Because we're not really moving the bill, but we want to discuss the amendment.
And we really didn't do amendments as well.
Right.
So, which, I mean, I'm totally comfortable with your, however you want to move things. I just, you know, I think it makes sense, certainly, what he's saying, and I think it's good language. So in that sense, it's great. I just didn't understand the process. So I was a couple of minutes late, so I didn't hear your opening comment.
Madam
Hott.
Chair.
Representative
Lewis. I think it's good that we put the amendment into this so that we have a document that we know that we're wanting to do whatever we want to do with it, so it doesn't get lost and it goes back to the old language. I just think that the old language is not acceptable by very knowledgeable people on your committee, and this language, the new language is. And so I think we should bring that bill up to a status of consent.
Representative Lilly.
Madam Chair and members, I think the language is strong, and I certainly would support it.
But if we put this amendment on at this time, that does not mean that necessarily that the bill goes on. But
I humbly accept whatever you're
but
doing, Madam Chair.
But it would be in the form that you wanted it to be considered to go on then. Am
Thank
I
you,
correct?
Madam Chair. That is correct.
Okay. Representative Hahn.
Thank you very much. This is a teamwork bill. And it has my authorship, but it has the workmanship of many people on your committee. And it's supposedly in a framework for expenditures from the Park and Trail Fund. But I think it's more than that. I think it's taking off parochial hats and trying to have a greater park plan for Minnesota. And I think that's whereabouts we should be headed. And it's asking for the Commissioner of Natural Resources to provide a collaborative project for a 25-year framework, but also develop a 10-year plan. And that 10-year plan, I think we have to have the groups that we've had coming to us, and that was the state and the metropolitan and an assortment of ad hoc regional people in regional parks. And my vision has changed in regional parks and regional park needs to actually being a combined metro regional park system and a greater Minnesota park system. So my vision has evolved since the committee has started. And I think we have to look at that regional park system as a combination of those two groups into one group. And so I would just like you to know that has changed. In addition to when we're talking about the groups, I think you always need to have a process that citizens are involved in, because citizens are who using our park and who elects us and who we're serving, and so that process has to be there. We listed out like 9 or 10 items on here for the framework. I would like to point out a couple, and one was the definition of parks and trails of regional significance. And in that case, I would really like to reinvent the wheel. And the reason I would like to reinvent the wheel, because I know the wheel works. And we do have definitions that are not written in law, but have worked very, very well in our granting process for our state agencies. And those are safe definitions and proven definitions that we do know that do no harm. When we start taking out new definitions, we say we know what it's going to do, but we often don't know what negative things that it might be doing. So I would like us to stay close to that. In 2.4, budgeting for ongoing maintenance, and I put or not next to my notes, quoting from our chair, favorite, Will, or not,
Because the area, the attitude of the maintenance and what type of maintenance is different in each of those regions. I also noted connectivity in 2.6, because when we talk about bike trails, when we have bike trails connecting things, the number of users really move up. When they're just there for recreation, then you have casual recreation. When they're actually going from somewhere to somewhere, you get a lot of use. As a representative, Lily, did you ride your bike this morning to work?
Representative Lily.
Madam Chair and Representative House, no, I went for a run this morning.
Thank you very much for that wonderful illustration. Now, but when you have an opportunity on a trail.
You ran here this morning?
After my crash, after our meeting the other night, well, after caucus, I decided I might want to run.
When we were talking about what's the longest trail and what's not the longest trail, and I was, you know, telling people I think the Wobegon Trail is, and then I Google it and prove that it is, and probably you could Google someplace else and prove that it is not.
Okay.
And then we start thinking about the high usages of trails, and you have to start thinking, where are these trails used for actually going from something to something? And in my lifetime, I've created a couple yellow bike programs, and a yellow bike program is where you have surplus bikes and you paint them a yellow color so that if they steal your bike, they look so dumb that they have to put it back, you know. And so I've had a couple yellow bike programs that have actually really worked. And if I was going to look for where maybe the highest density would be, I would look for the section of Wobegon between St. John's and St. Ben's, that the students for academic purposes only, for academic purposes, but they can ride from one campus to the other to take a class. And so then you get massive amounts of communication in that direction. I know of other trails where there's dormitories connected to activities too, so those are really high grade. So we should be looking for that area and those connectors. This is actually a wonderful opportunity for this committee to go after a direction of knowing what we have in Minnesota, or should we be knowing, and we have an awful lot of studies with dust that can be shaken off and used, and you have an awful lot of experts within the state. Then we have to define what do we really need or want within the system. I think we need to have knowledge of our system, and we need to right away notice that we have uniqueness. What is up north is not the same as what is in central Minnesota, is not the same as what is in metro. And we have to have those regions define what they have and what they need, and we have to be, as a committee and as a state, a helping hand to move this to an actual Minnesota system. Not a greater Minnesota, not a rural Minnesota, not a metro, but a park system for the entire state, that we act as helpers to define that and help move that forward in specifics of what those regions need to their uniqueness. And you're going to find that that is great difference. In my area, central Minnesota, in Stearns County and St. Cloud, we have a pretty well-developed area. We have the threat of having, not a threat, the challenge, the uniqueness that in central Minnesota, St. Cloud, will have 200,000 more people living there in 2020. And that is going to take a lot of land mass, and it's going to have a lot of people looking for using a park and using of park trails and bike trails. Before I leave you, I would like to tell you, in my 32 years as a park director, the thing that evolved parks to a different era was bike trails. Mm-hmm. At one time, we thought the way to go was everybody should have their own top park, everybody should have their own little neighborhood park. And all of a sudden, the merits of bike trails are coming. And it was connecting regional parks by a bicycle mode. And that is where we're at, and I think that's going to stay for a long, long time. I would take questions on this if you wish me to.
Representative Lilly.
Madam Chair and Representative House and members, yesterday I had an opportunity to review a video that somebody sent me with Garrison Keeler up at your opening of your trail that you're referring to. It was quite a nice little tape and looks like a nice trail, so I pledged you that I'll be up there this summer and ride it. Just wondering, as the other day when we were kind of going through some of the other issues related to this, Mr. Myers kind of talked about how we, you know, maybe how a plan and like how an oversight or how they would look at this. And if we have someone here today from the DNR, maybe they could come up and kind of say how this would, you know, how they would work this out or how a plan would work, or if Madam Chair is interested in how they'd run the process or something like that, or if interested. I don't know. I think it might be helpful to
Ms. Martinson,
just to hear for a couple seconds.
Commissioner Martinson, welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, committee members. My name is
Lori
Martinson. I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Natural Resources. We do have a draft outline of a plan. As the authors mentioned, there already is substantial information about the non-metro regional system, the metro regional system, and the state regional parks and trails system. And the state legislature has designed the system through Minnesota, the Outdoor Recreation System, 86A, and the Metro Regional Park System in 473, and some of the other regional parks in Chapter 85. What's happened is we haven't pulled those all together yet. Back in 2003, the AMC put together a report for the LCCMR and inventoried all of those non-metro regional parks. We have a substantial document, right?
Yes.
That is very big and very large, but right now it's all data mostly, and it's not information. It's not assembled in a way that someone could actually use to understand what the base is of the system that we have. And we could, I think, readily pull together the metropolitan parks information, the state system, and then this data that's already been collected. And we think within a very short time frame the department could put together and make available on the web and make available in a report what the whole state system looks like. Because the data's there, it's just not been put together in a way that you can use it. Regarding how you move this forward, the author's bill would have the DNR work with all of those authorities to put together the framework and the strategic direction. I think it'd be important for the department to be able to fully participate in that process. And one of my initial thoughts, I haven't talked to our other partners yet, but we were thinking that we'd do a national search for someone who could come in and help us with that planning and facilitation so that they could lead that for us, and we would jointly be selecting whoever that was, and then we could participate as a department along with the Metropolitan Council and the non-metro regional part. So that's initially what we're thinking about. We could certainly do it on our own and try not bring any bias to the table, and we would pledge to do that, but it's makes it a little more difficult to be able to fully participate. And then regarding the public participation, we're looking at a web survey tool, which we would design and make available, several regional listening sessions. We would want to make sure that we're targeting lots of different populations and trying to get to where people really are so we get meaningful input. And then trying to make some of those maybe available on our web, too, so that you could interact and people could listen to some of the conversations. Because sometimes it's hard to think about what you want the future to be like, and you can engage in a dialogue, or at least you can hear a dialogue. You can participate differently. So those are some of the initial things that we have in mind.
Commissioner Martinson, go back to your part about finding a person to pull this, to lead the plan so that mm-hmm. you can be a participant. It's not popping in my head as part of my vision.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'll be happy to do that. Initially, I'm thinking that there's going to be substantial efforts to develop the process and how you would move through this so that you actually get the input when you need it and you're considering it in the development of the framework and of the strategic vision and direction. And I think that by bringing in a third party that we all agree with, who has expertise and experience in this subject matter, who has done this before in maybe other places, they can maybe help us move forward. If we're not able to find someone like that, the department is ready and willing to step up to the plate and do that. And we would try and set any bias we might have about promoting state parks and state trails aside in the better interest of making sure that, you know, we can provide for the outdoor recreation of the state. But initially, that's my thought.
Okay, and that person would be like just for that aspect of the plan.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. So like a consultant.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lawler. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Deputy Commissioner Martinson. I think it's always good to have sort of that independent third party when you have all these different systems around the table. I would actually say that it would be better to have someone who doesn't have expertise in this, because then they force everyone around the table to be clear about what they're talking about. Because what I found sometimes is that it might be people in one system use a term this way and another this one, and they think they're talking and they're not. We all bring with ourselves our own history of what we think a trail means. And to some people it's only a bike trail, and they couldn't imagine a walker on it. And, you know, other people, it's of course multimodal, and you're going to have people on rollerblades and all kinds of other things. So I think you need to be careful. I think in the planning, and I think this is a bigger issue for us, I have suggested to some people that we need to create some baseline data in order to measure the impact of the investments that we're going to make. And I see that you have a goal to increase the number of visitors, which I think is a wonderful thing. I think a lot of times people aren't aware of it. I think that's a similar goal to what we've talked about in the arts and the historical culture area. And I would hope that we would do one assessment of all of these things, not separate ones from each item. And I would suggest that we work with our higher education institutions, that we allow them all to bid on the possibility of being involved in some real survey work that might make a big difference. And because I think that's really motivating when you're taking statistic classes or other things, to actually feel like it's something real and not something just for a class assignment. And so I hope that as we're evolving all these ideas in these different funds, we look at opportunities for collaborative input and data gathering, so we're not paying for one survey for one purpose and then paying the exact same amount for another scientific survey for another purpose as we go forward and start to put the pieces together.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hawk.
In all respect, I like the approach that you're going to get somebody that is neutral, but I sure like experts. I mean, I get this picture of applying for a job and saying, I can do this better because I've never done it before. I can do this better because I don't know anything about it. You know, and so I think as we look for neutral, we still have to have an aspect of having people that have backgrounds, that have education, that have visions, that have worked with visions, that have had other experiences, that as we put those forward. I would like to again go back to stress the uniqueness of different regions within the state, and we do not have a system that defines and helps those regions grow in unity so that they have a regional voice. And we've been close, and the state has been close, and the state has made recommendations. So when they dust those off, I would hope that those pages move forward for some consideration so that we can be talking to a region and asking them to prioritize and asking them to come together and bringing their people together to define what they have, what they would like to save, what they would like to connect, what they would like to do into the future. Because the people that live in the region know more about the region than anybody else.
Are there any other comments or questions for Representative Hawes, or any other statements made in particular about the ideas contained in House File 1967 and the preferred language for line 3 on, or for part 3 on line 2.2 and 2.3 of page 2.
Madam Chair, in closing?
Rep. Van Hoss.
I feel that this is a very good direction to be headed in. It's an honest direction to be headed in, and I almost brought a picture of myself with a real fish to a staple it to prove that this is an honest direction for us. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Representative Virginia, House File 1086, and I think there's probably a few people here, special to hear about this. And members, there is in your packet a letter from Don McMillan, who was here yesterday, was not able to be here today. He's the president of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance, and I asked him because he stated that he could not be here today, I asked him to give me something in writing and I would distribute it, and that's why the letter is in your packet. Representative Virginia.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Let me tell you why House File 1086 is before you. It has been through, but before I do that, to tell you, it's been through the Policy and Environment Finance Committee, both of the committees. When we did the constitutional amendment 2 years ago, our initial bill created four funds and literally had two sentences about the fund. Literally two. That was it. And we had made a determination at that time that we did not want any more language because, well, first of all, it takes a lot of time to develop it, and that was the question is whether we could even spend the time doing it. But it was also not to distract folks from who were voting on the constitutional amendment to any side issues. So it was an intentional leaving that on the table, just with the two sentences in each fund. Toward the end of the session, the Outdoor Heritage Council was voted on, approved and voted on, signed by the governor.
But where was that voted on?
By the legislature. The Outdoor Heritage Council, the creation of the council was created separately from the constitutional amendment. The constitutional amendment was created first and voted on. Later on in the legislative process, the Heritage Council came into being.
In the game of fish, yeah.
That's correct.
Thank you.
So, what, I'll tell you, just to give you a couple of things that I want to talk to you about. As we were talking about some of the things that we needed to do to flesh out the legislation besides the two sentences, I had conversations with the chair of our Ways and Means Committee, and we talked about what we affectionately call around here as TAILS, and we talked about the fact that we have over 1 million acres of wildlife management area that's never been restored. We've purchased the land, that was a good thing, but we've never set aside the money, or we didn't have a plan to set aside the money to restore it. That's a bad thing. And it's bad because it's not as good hunting land or walking land. And when you have lands that have not been restored, they become weedy, and then they become even harder to manage, and farmers don't like them either. And they want the lands to be well managed. So you want, when you purchase a piece of land, not only to purchase it, but to do the restoration. You also want to have a plan for the long-term management, because anything we're going to do in this constitutional amendment is going to be permanent. And so you want to have a long-term management plan. And how do you make sure that those dollars are there for the long-term management? And the third thing we talked about is we have a tradition in the state of payment in lieu of taxes to counties. It's almost what I would consider a host fee. And so we have talked about that. So what you're going to see is actually two bills that I am bringing to you that really should be viewed in combination, because the first one deals with that purchase of the land, or deals with the expansion of the fund language, but then it also deals with the purchases of land and make sure that that land is actually restored. The second bill looks at the long-term management and the filtration issues. So they really do need to be viewed together, and that's, I wanted just to mention that before I started, because they really come to you in combination. They were drafted separately at different times. As we were talking about and talking to folks about voting for the constitutional amendment, there were many conversations of people wanting to know what they got for the dollar. And our commitment to them was, we are going to make sure we can let you know what you got for the dollar. And so House File 1086 starts off by saying that in the legislative in our Legislative Coordinating Commission, we are asking them to hire somebody to do a website. It's called a Legislative Accountability Office, but it's really the accountability is hiring somebody to do a website that will do two things. It will have all of the things that have been purchased with this money up on the website, including the defined outcome, the evaluation, and how what people really got for their money. That will go up on the website. Also on the website, I would expect that we would have a place for people to go to say, you can apply for a one-stop shop. Here's where you look if you want to apply for LCCMR dollars, or here's where you want to look if you want to apply for LASAR dollars, or here's where you want to look if you want to know about parks and trails and how those dollars are going to be appropriated. It's an information thing. It's not doing anything except providing information to Minnesotans, but it is a one place where you can do that. So that is the vision. Legislative Coordinating Commission has given us a fiscal note. It is carried in the water and in the Parks and Trails, the dollars, their portion of the dollars, they would be spread across everybody, but to pay for that webmaster who is going to bring all this information together for Minnesotans. So then as we look at the next section of this bill, it's called Restoration Audit. We expect that there'll be many restorations done with money, and Parks and Trails money is Heritage Council, LCCMR, all of them. And our legislative auditor does financial audit, does program audit. This is a new responsibility that they're willing to take on, is to do a spot check to make sure that citizens are getting what they pay for. That's essentially what that is. Okay, now I'm at the bottom of page 2, and you'll see at the bottom of page 2 the exact language with it, which we adopted 2 years ago. But then we go into what House File 1086 does, and it begins with the expenditures and accountability for parks and trails. What you're going to see, because this is dealing with actually there are four separate funds in here. Each fund has, a lot of it has identical language, so I will do it once, but then just point out how the same language is applying to other sections. Yeah, if that's all right with you, Madam Chair.
That's fine.
Okay. So we're starting with Parks and Trails and its expenditures or accountability. And this, if you look on line 3-3, it says a project or program must include measurable outcomes, a plan for measuring, and evaluating the results. This is, in LCCMR terms, the deliverables. But here's the one thing that's a little bit different and I want you all to think about. Oftentimes, we give people money and then we go up and check and pay somebody else to go and check up and say, this has done that money correctly. This is really starting and making the person who is applying for the money responsible for telling us what their measurable outcomes are, their plan for measuring, and asking them to do the measurement and evaluation. So the price of that is incorporated into the project. Okay? The second thing we're talking about is on 3-8, is funding must be requested and granted for an entire project, even if the project will take multiple years to complete. That is a harder thing to get around, but we have had a habit in the legislature of appropriating in small segments and maybe the project never being completed because the legislature in 3 or 4 years does not fund that. This is saying to Minnesotans, when we are promising you something, we will deliver. On 3-1-1, we're saying biennially, money from Parks and Trails funds will be expended to balance the benefits across all regions and residents of the state. We've talked about balance in this committee a lot. D is all information must be made available on the web as soon as practicable. The web is the one we've talked about initially. And the grants shall be implemented by according to our current state rules from the grant folks. And on 3-20, it says priority for grants proposals must be given to proposals involving grants that will be competitively awarded. And on 3-2-2, we're going to have those signs. We've talked about those in this committee, letting people know that these are your constitutional dollars at work. Okay. G says all money from Parks and Trails must be expended in Minnesota. Intuitive, but we thought we'd spell it out. The data availability is just making sure, this is the language that has been carried in the LCCMR bill for years. I don't think it's controversial at all. It's just making sure that all the data gets into our system in the same manner. Subdivision 4 says a project receiving an appropriation or appropriations from Parks and Trails fund totaling more than $10 million or more in a biennium is subject to additional requirements. So if we're spending a lot of money, let's be especially careful. The Attorney General must review and approve all contracts and real estate transactions, including conservation easements, and make a determination that they are in the best interest of the state and whether they meet all applicable requirements. And 2, we require a second appraisal. Okay. Now we are looking into our next fund, which is the Heritage Council. Coming from the Environment Policy and Environment Finance Committees, it was recommended that the Legislative Coordinating Commission provide administrative support for the Council and the exact support that should be provided. I think that's a discussion that this committee will have. The council's recommendations, instead of saying take into consideration, it says we'll achieve the existing natural resource plans that we have, including the Minnesota Statewide Conservation and Preservation Plan. It suggests that the council work with the other commissions and Bordenmore, Bowser, and other agencies that we already have. On G, this is on 7.3, it says the council should develop and implement a process that ensures that citizens and potential recipients are included throughout the process, including the development and finalization of the council's recommendations. These are the normal processes that we like to include to keep citizens involved across the state. We changed the language from an independent auditor to the legislative auditor, mainly because we don't want to duplicate, and financial audits are only part of the kind of auditing that our auditor does. Our auditor actually does more, and that's a good, because we also do program, he also does program audits. Okay, now we get down at the bottom of page 7 and talks about the priorities and expenditure requirements and saying that a project receiving funding from the Outdoor Heritage Fund must meet or exceed the constitutional requirements to restore, protect, and enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for game and fish. This is just repeating the constitutional language, which we often do in statute. On 8A2, project must be consistent with current science and, where appropriate, incorporate state-of-the-art technology. Again, we come with this 8.6, funding must be required, and you're going to hear now the repeated language that I already did for parks and trails, but I just will highlight a little bit here. Funding must be requested and granted for an entire project, even if it will take multiple years to complete. And let me give you the example of a prairie restoration by the piece of land. It may take 6 years to complete that whole project. A prairie restoration is maybe perhaps is not hard, but you have to have a multiple-year process of burn and taking away the brush and perhaps a second burn, maybe even a third burn. And so we want to make sure that we don't get into the same trap that we got into with funds for wildlife management areas where we have a lot of land, but it's never been restored. So biannual balance, grants following state law, money spent in Minnesota. Those are the same things we've always had. 819, we're asking for the measurable outcomes, and to the extent practicable, include in a proposal a list of any lands to be acquired, protected, or restored, identify the entity that will hold the title or easement, and then in C, I want to call your attention to that. Lands acquired by fee, restored, or protected by easements with money from the Heritage Fund should ensure the viability of Minnesota's natural systems by supporting native biological diversity and their ecological complexes, and provide protection against invasive species, and must meet one or more of the following criteria. I think this is kind of the basics of what Minnesotans would expect their money would be expended for. Number one, identified as an area of biodiversity significance by the County Biological Survey. So this is the kinds of lands you're looking for. Two, maintains or enhances native plant, fish, or wildlife species as designated as endangered or threatened. Number three, maintains a native ecological community. Number four, possesses a unique quality that is of value to biodiversity of the region. number five, or adjacent to any of one, to lands meeting one or more of the requirements above, and that if restored or protected, will enhance those adjacent lands, or, remember this is a list, and this is an or list, are degraded lands that if restored would provide or contribute to a critical habitat corridor for native plants, fish, and wildlife. We haven't had many discussions about corridors in this committee, but corridors are very important for wildlife and our native species, our plants. So we want to work in corridors. 9-10, we want things to be perpetually protected, have an ecological restoration plan with sufficient funding for implementation. So you're seeing themes here. The ecological restoration plan must, to the degree practicable, be consistent with the highest quality conservation and ecological goals for the restoration site. The plan needs a timeline, identify long-term maintenance. I'm now on lines 19-19, how that maintenance will be financed, taking advantage of the most current science. We're using the native local ecotype language that we talked about last night on the floor and that the Heritage Council has already adopted. These lands are restored or protected by these easements with the money for the Heritage Fund are not eligible for some other funds like wetland replacement or mitigation credits. Displaying the sign, just like we've talked about in other places. And now, there is an H. This is transparency. That's exactly what that land language is about, making sure the public knows how all of its dollars are spent. In 10-6, says if the owner of real interest in real property acquired with money from this fund may not alter the intended use without notifying the council in writing. 10-10 says a recipient of money from the Heritage Fund shall not use the funds to cover any organizational operational expenses not related to the project being funded. Coming back to the website, putting all the information on the website, the data availability is what I've talked to you about before. Reports required, which are standard kinds of things that we do. This 1116, the special review of project receiving an appropriation of over $10 million, same language that was carried in the park. And now we're down to the Clean Water Fund. And I'm going to be just telling you that much of what I have said before is repeated in here. And I don't know that at this time of the morning you want me to repeat all of that all over again, but it is there. And then in the policy, when we drafted this bill, it did not include the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. And Representative Egan added this in the policy committee. I did not attempt to work with this language, not having that expertise, and thought I would just bring it to this committee, and this committee certainly is going to work with that language of account. And so with that, members, I'd be glad to take any questions.
So, Representative Virginia, I haven't been on the previous committee, so I haven't heard this presentation, but from this, I guess that you are recommending an accountability office within the Legislative Coordinating Committee. And that office would be the main office to keep accounts and have knowledge of what the four funds are doing. or the people in the four funds are doing and how they are carrying out what the appropriations that this committee and the legislature recommend.
I think my task is a little narrower than that. I think that what we want to do is to be able to tell the public how their monies are being expended. So the information would come from the from Parks and Trails, and the information would go up on the website and say, these are the outcomes that this park got. This proposal for this trail, this is what they proposed, this is the outcome that they said that they were going to deliver. They've now expended their money, and this evaluated how it worked and said these are the measurable outcomes that Minnesotans are receiving for the money expended. It is up on the website for Minnesotans to see. And so I expect that Minnesotans are going to be pleased to see how their money is spent. But we have so often heard the dollar went into a black hole. This is not a black hole. This will be the bright light.
And because we know what the outcomes are, the expected outcomes are on the front end,
yes,
then we'll be able to follow their progress as they go along.
That's correct.
The legislative auditor is, this bill is asking the legislative auditor to have responsibilities over programming audits.
Absolutely.
Of the four funds.
Absolutely. Expecting the legislative auditor to do its traditional function plus one, and that would be restoration audits.
All right. Representative, and those are the two main parts of what the accountability office would be doing.
Well, I guess I see the legislative auditor is just separate. It's more of its traditional function. We have a good legislative audit system. Essentially, what we're doing is adding one function to that system. That's really the only change there. We would expect the legislative auditor to do what the legislative auditor has always done for these funds. There's one thing additional we're asking the legislative auditor to do.
And Representative Wagenius, in this House File 1086, this would be in appropriations that are appropriated in 2010?
Well, this, of course, this has not been enacted into law, so this would be from... This could be going forward, not obviously anything that we've done will do this year. It will be starting, well, I assume it will go into effect August 1st, as most of our legislation does, and it would move forward.
Thank you for that clarification. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Wagenius. This is a really good package of oversight and accountability measures. On page 10, line 10, it says, a recipient of money from the Outdoor Heritage Fund shall not use the funds to cover any organizational or operational expenses not related to the project being funded. We know that in these projects there are direct costs and there are indirect costs.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the intent of this language to include those indirect costs as well, or are you speaking only of the direct costs of the project?
What I hope this language is saying is the project pays for its direct costs, but that we do not pay indirect organizational costs. I believe I'm correct in saying that that is the rule that the LCCMR follows.
Thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Wagenius. There's a number of places in your bill where you use the terms restored and restoration. Do we have a definition for what those terms actually mean?
We do not.
Do we need one?
Representative Wagenius.
I think that's more of a more complex issue than something that we could simply off the cuff write. I think it's something that we could tackle. But a restoration for a forest, a restoration for a prairie, a restoration for a wetland, these are complex issues. We do address in here quality, and we're looking for quality because we're asking for current science using local ecotypes. That would be for forests. I mean, our forestry division already does that. They're very good about that. But if we're getting into the details of restoration, I think that's a very difficult thing to make sure that a wetland is a functioning wetland. It should be. That's the way it should be, but we do not get into the detail in this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And along these same lines, it just seems like, you know, my general impression of the language in the bill is that it is quite restrictive, but yet it's using terms that are not defined, and I do have some difficulty with that, not really knowing what we're getting into. I mean, your definition of restored and my definition of restored might be different. Native species, for instance, I've mentioned this before, but the ringneck pheasant is not a native species of Minnesota. And I'm sure that there are many folks that supported this bill that would not be too interested in us eliminating the ringneck pheasant from the state of Minnesota. And habitat that supports the ringneck pheasant may not always be strictly native species. We may want other species involved to provide the proper food and protection for these, for the ringneck pheasant, for instance. So I'm having some difficulty with this, what seems to me to be quite restrictive language in the bill aimed at restoration.
Representative Woodie,
local ecotype is applying to it's applying to plants, not animals. But with restoration, I think when you're talking about pheasant and what pheasant like, that is an excellent example of why science is important and why it would be very difficult to define restoration at this point. And I'm thinking of work done by Dr. Sean Schertler at the Science Museum, and he has done a lot of work on what is attractive to our native species, birds, ducks, and pheasants. And what his work tells us is that pheasants actually like native prairie. But we don't get into that in this bill. And I think that is a very complex thing to deal with. It takes a lot of science. And, Madam Chair, that is an interest of yours that I would pledge that our committee would do hearings and look at those words and be very careful and bring scientists in to help us do some definitions. But I don't think it's something that I would want to tackle on the fly.
And not something that we could do before April 30th. We probably should have continued discussions. Yeah. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One more question, not related to the restoration issue, but related to the accountability issue, where you've put a lot of language in here relating to accountability and making sure that our dollars, to quote you, don't go down the black hole. But what happens if there's a project where the dollars do go down a black hole or where outcomes are not attained? Are you proposing consequences for the recipients of these funds? Would you ask for the money back? Would you throw them into the ecological jailhouse? Or just what, you know, it's great to have accountability, I understand that, but I don't understand how, what the expectations are.
Representative Genius.
There is no jail provision in here. And what I think, having, if somebody doesn't do their job, my guess is they won't get the next grant. And so they're having, because the people who are going to do the grant work are going to be looking. Did we get those outcomes? Did we get that evaluation? Were they measurable outcomes? So there, by having those outcomes in here, not only do Minnesotans get accountability, but the folks who are doing the granting have the measures, and they will know, did this group or that group or this trail proposer do what they promised they were going to do?
Representative Harkel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will end my questioning at this point in the interest of time.
Thank you. Good question. So yeah, good thing we've got to think about that before the 30th. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Wagenius, I want to focus on the special review component that is really across the board in each of the funds where there's an appropriation of $10,000 or more in a biennium. And my question is exactly how would that work? Because I can see appropriation going to an entity, and then that entity distributes funds through grants. I'm thinking particularly in Bowser with the RIM and Wetland Reserve, but I could see that also in Clean Water. I could see it in parks. So if we appropriate $9 million to Bowser, and then they have willing landowners who are coming forward who have a project for restoring wetlands that may cost $60,000, $78,000, and we have a contract that between not the appropriation going to that landowner, but the appropriation going to Bowser, and then the landowner having a grant that's a contract review that's approved, an appraisal that's done. I'm wondering how that fits in, and I could see it in the arts as well, where maybe an entity where there's appropriation that goes to the entity, let's say for the Historical Society, and they distribute that out to a specific county. I'm just wondering where the Attorney General, if the Attorney General reviews each of those contracts or not.
If I could, Representative Virginia.
I think perhaps my language is not specific enough, and we can, if this is something we adopt, then Mr. McCormick can help us out here. I'm viewing this as an individual project. An expensive individual project would have a special review. So it is one project costing over $10 million in a biennium rather than a series of smaller grants.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wagenius, I did misspeak on the $10 million, but I could see if we had maybe in a year there's $10 million that's given to Bowser, or there's $10 million that's given to the Historical Society. So I think the question still applies. And Madam Chair, I do apologize. I have a family issue this morning. Couldn't be here on time. So I think the question is still applicable, and we'd be willing to work on how to clear that up.
Well, we can, if this a language is adopted, we would ask for the requirements to make this a little more clear.
All right. 9:20 is the time of that is on the calendar as or on the agenda as the adjournment time. But before that, Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes of the 27th meeting from Wednesday, April 22nd, as submitted.
Okay. And we will continue this agenda, the uncompleted portion of the agenda, including more discussion on Representative Wagenius's 1186 bill that we are on. I suggest that you leave these things in your packet, and at the next opportunity on today's Thursday, on Friday's meeting, we will continue. I do not at this time have a time for Friday's meeting, but there will be one. It is my expectation that there will be one at this time. If people wish to submit written comments for as far as we've gone, they will be accepted by me or Mr. Chen, and they will be reproduced for everyone on the committee packet. And we are moving ahead no matter what it seems like. Thank you for your cooperation. We also may have additional items added to the agenda. All in favor of the minutes of the Morgan motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are adopted. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Madam.